This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the art worlds and artivism. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It's episode 243 with Max Haven. It's our third chapter in talking about his book, Art After Money, Money After Art, and all the tangents that come out of it in this episode. And I know you guys are itching, scratching for more. And if you have questions, by the way, we are going to be talking at least one more time, maybe just one more time. So if you have questions, send them my way. We talk about in this episode Paolo Cirio's astounding 2014 piece, Loophole for All, Valentina Karga and Peter Jan Grandry's piece, Valentina and Peter Invest in Themselves, and Bay Area Cassie Thornton's incredibly effective Give Me Cred alternative credit report project. That and so much more. And I'm going to jump right in a second, but I just want to let you know, if you want to pass on the really heavy stuff, we do talk about this topic, which Max had mentioned in prior conversations, called cruel optimism, which was coined and has been written extensively by the writer Lauren Berlant. We talk about that for quite a while. I think it's really tied in with all of our current lives, especially in 2019. But if you want to avoid that heaviness, as well as conversation about hype and confidence factors in success, a breakdown of critical art and the expediency of culture, and get all the way to our first actual discussion of artwork, which is Paolo Cirio's aforementioned piece, skip ahead about 41 and a half minutes from now. On the back end, four very tight old news clips, and then we are off. I will talk to you more on the back end. Thank you very much for being here, and I'll talk to you then.
A listener did have a question that came out of the last conversation, and I'll give you a little bit of context. In terms of when she was referring to in the conversation, she said just before we were reading about Haka and MoMA, and she said you were speaking about the value of art being more or less constructed and held in place by consensus in the art world, and that you mentioned galleries, museums, and collectors. But she was particularly curious as to where academia figures in that. She thought maybe you're giving them a pass. And just to add a little bit more, she wrote, when important educators choose which artists they prefer to write and teach year after year, aren't they eventually, trickle-down theory in parentheses, wielding the same kind of power over the art market as museums, collectors, and big galleries? Before you you answer, my thought was that I thought academia was less affecting for the market value and all of that because it's sort of a pre-launch, although you may have heard about this art fair that's coming up in the November, I think, that's a MFA program themed art fair. You know, it's going to include the big, and it's been criticized quite a bit, as you can imagine. So anyway, I'll leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting question. I mean, I'd be happy to talk through it. I think on some level, we do need to account for the influence that faculty do have. And I would say very particularly their faculty at the top sort of 5 to 10 MFA programs and, you know, very prestigious universities who, yes, are educating the next generation of curators, the next generation of collectors and people who serve collectors, and the next generation of artists. So the sort of the canons that they teach and the artists that they select and also the former students that they support, they do have influence. But I think, and I should say that I think art markets also depend on academics and critics legitimating art as a means to give it a kind of market value.
Which is what we talked about towards the beginning of our last call, if you recall.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I would say, though, in the whole mix of things, I think that most academics don't see themselves as particularly powerful within art markets. They're sort of their validation of artworks is a necessary but not sufficient criteria for allowing a work to be valued tremendously. And in fact, there's a huge number of very high-selling artists' work, like someone like Jeff Koons, who I don't think anyone's really written about positively in a couple of decades, who continue to do extremely well in spite of it. And I think that has a lot to do with the kind of the tastes that are shaping the art market now, who don't particularly care what academics have to say and don't read very much.
Mm-hmm. So would you say maybe another way of putting it is that, based on how I'm interpreting what you initially said about this, is that the academics have an influence on artists and, to a lesser extent, curators when they're in a graduate program, and then when they leave that program, they will then, you know, be their own level of influence, but they will not, they will only have been formerly attached to these academics.
I think that's one element of it, though I could think off the top of my head of a few other ways in which academics do have influence. I mean, many academics also write for trade periodicals and publications about art, and in that way validate and verify art as sort of the bona fide item. I also think that academics in a certain way are often invited to speak at art venues, and thereby also create a kind of legitimation. I know certainly within a number, but not all art contexts, having your work as an artist written about by academics certainly allows you to be taken much more seriously as someone who has, you know, some important sort of social commentary or place within the artistic canon. So I don't think it's just the kind of the influence of the kind of grand poobahs of art history and art MFA programs who have all of the influence. There's a number of ways. I guess what I would say maybe schematically is just that, like, academics, including myself, are part of the same economic ecosystem that I'm criticizing throughout. No one's really innocent here.
Right. Yeah, and as you were talking, though, about ones who write, academics who write, I was immediately thinking of Art Forum, and that academics who would publish there, particularly cover, you know, profiles of the cover artist, that is definitely a huge source of influence, you know, in terms of press, you know, slash Art Forum. It's like the Art Forum validation that is analogous to the museum validation.
Yeah, I think absolutely. There is an element of that. And we can even think, I mean, Art Forum presents a fairly, like, a fairly sort of centrist establishment organ. But we can even think about the influence of a kind of Marxist art journal like October in the sort of way that certain art careers and artists get validated. And even a more recent, less academic publication like Eflux has a certain, you know, way that it delivers a certain legitimacy on artists. Now, in saying all that, I don't want to be heard to be saying that anyone who's had their work covered in these periodicals is just a charlatan who's sort of being propped up by this kind of class of high priests of art, and really, you know, that all the art is the same, and some art just gets kind of selected to be elevated to this rule through the kind of sophistry of academic discourse. I don't think that's true. There's a lot of art that is extremely important, and I think that many of the forms of criticism and writing about art actually does illuminate why some of this art is so important in our historical age, or why it's worth looking at or experiencing. But I also want to keep an eye more cynically on ultimately what is my interest, which is the political economy of art and the way that artistic value and economic value are deeply entangled.
Right. Okay. Well, I think that's enough information about academia and its influence, so maybe we'll leave it there for now. So then, continuing back to your book and our part three of our conversation, which there's this term cruel optimism, which you used, I think, at least a couple of times over the last, probably a couple of times in the first conversation and maybe once in the last. And I think our objective is to maybe, as you do, certainly do in the book, but for our much shorter abbreviated version here, bring it back to what it's important is in terms of art or art and finance. And I was particularly interested, as you may have seen from my notes, that even though, as you pointed out when we spoke last time, you know, this is a couple of years ago now that you wrote this, right? It's been a good solid 2 years, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was particularly interested that just a month or so ago, the New Yorker writer Wasu wrote a piece of his own about her that's called That Feeling When, What Affect Theory Teaches About the New Age of Anxiety, which maybe we can get to briefly in a second. But why don't I just read a little bit? I'm not going to read everything. I'm going to try for the listener's sake. By the way, I haven't gotten much in the way of feedback, so I don't know where listeners are in terms of, you know, this is way too much to take in. Yes, I enjoyed it. I just don't want to tell you, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So you say, for Lauren Berlant, who is the writer who coined this term and has described it quite a bit, cruel optimism names a public feeling made up of the spectrum of effective strategies by which subjects cope with and maintain their participation in the set of ultimately destructive socioeconomic and cultural conditions, which we have here heralded under the banner of financialization. A little further, you go on to write, Berlant's investigation is concerned with the question of how it is that, against all odds, and in spite of so little objective chance of success and happiness, the vast majority of us continue to participate in a system of work, life, debt, and social normativity that is objectively killing us, some more slowly than others, and making most of us tremendously miserable. She seeks to trace the outlines in several instances of the mobilization of a kind of Pyrrhic hope that better things are around the corner, that the good life awaits. As she puts it, optimism is cruel when the object or scene that ignites a sense of possibility actually makes it impossible to attain the expansive transformation for which a person or a people risks striving. And doubly, it is cruel insofar as the very pleasures of being inside a relation have become sustaining regardless of the content of the relation, such that a person or a world finds itself bound to a situation of profound threat that is, at the same time, profoundly confirming. So maybe you can just unpack that a little bit in more vernacular language and maybe talk about why the timing of this, you know, not only, you know, as she was got that little critical review in New Yorker, you know, just recently, but maybe more, I don't know, in the 2016 and so on era, perhaps it's connected to that.
Yeah. Well, I think Berlant has done us a great service in introducing this concept because it describes something that we, I think, all have experienced, and it gives a name to this affect, what gets termed an affect, like a kind of a feeling, but a feeling that's not just individual, that's kind of collective and societal. And I think what Berlant points out is this has something to do with a moment in which we are aware of the consequences of systemic and structural forces that are operating around us, but we feel somewhat helpless in the face of them. So we end up undertaking activities in our society that are cruelly optimistic. So let me give you an example. We are sort of increasingly aware that climate change is a massive catastrophic problem. And yet the solutions that we are constantly fed in the mass media for very particular political economic reasons, but that also we internalize, is a cruelly optimistic idea that if we just used better light bulbs or ran or, you know, had shorter showers or took these kind of individual actions to save energy, we would somehow be contributing to saving the environment, which is objectively nonsense. The only way that we'll essentially stop runaway climate change is by dramatically reining in the massive corporations that are making tons of money by sacrificing the Earth's ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
But the cruel optimism kind of protects us from the consequences of that realization, which would demand a wholesale transformation of our way of life and our political system and our economic system, by instead giving us what is essentially a useless activity that we can be optimistic about,
mm-hmm.
but the optimism sustains us in a condition that is actually destroying our lives. So
mm-hmm.
another example is, you know, constantly playing the lottery, imagining that you'll win.
Right.
So that, and that allows you to sustain a life where you go back to your horrible job every day
mm-hmm.
and put up with, you know, living in poverty and degradation because you have this kind of cruel optimism that eventually you're going to strike the jackpot, even though sort of underneath it all, you kind of realize that it's not that it's not going to come to pass.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's so interesting about this notion of cruel optimism as Berlant presents it, is it's not just, she's not just trying to condemn people for being stupid and not understanding the consequences of their actions. She's actually saying that this is something that we all participate in and we all experience in many different aspects of our lives because the structural and systemic forces seem so unchangeable. So, you know, even Berlant herself in that very good New Yorker piece, the feature on her, it's pointed out sort of, and I myself sort of convince ourselves, have a kind of cruel optimism that somehow if we get our analysis of capitalism right, somehow that's going to have some sort of impact. And, you know, I don't know, people are going to rise up and there'll be some sort of revolution or some sort of systemic change. I mean, that's cruel optimism, but it's a cruel optimism that keeps me and presumably her going every day.
Mm-hmm.
And in throughout my book, I sort of identify cruel optimism as at play often in various aspects of the art world, but also I try and talk about how it gets reversed into what I call benign pessimism as well by certain artists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I wonder then, you just mentioned the connection to the art world and artists. I wonder if many of us artists are operating in a dynamic of cruel optimism, like, you know, if we just keep making our work, something is going to break, you know, things are going to break here and there. I wonder if that there's, I don't think that you wrote it that way, but I wonder if there's not a connection there as well.
I certainly think that's true. I think it's especially true of younger artists who have a kind of dream that someday their work and their creativity will be recognized by the art market and the art world. And that is going to be a good thing because, of course, often success is the worst thing you can imagine in a horrible system. And there's plenty of stories of artists, you know, being extremely abused or exploited in the art world amidst their success or finding out that success comes with its own sort of challenges and horrors. And I think more generally, those artists who are seeking to make sort of politicized art or art that seeks to sort of awaken the imagination of the audience about worldly affairs, there's quite a lot of cruel optimism among both artists and many other people in various art worlds that somehow the art is going to transform people's imaginations automatically. And, you know, someone's going to go into a gallery and be dazzled by a piece, and then that's going to completely transform their experience of reality and their sort of political activism. It's not to say that doesn't happen, but it certainly doesn't happen as often, and usually it doesn't happen in the way that we imagine.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that there are artists that you described as being successful and at the same time being put in a place of great maybe existential crisis or something along those lines. And I would certainly love to talk to them, but I think they're pretty hard to find. You know, they're certainly not advertising their situations. I would imagine that anybody who is financially, you know, / market successful as an artist, the last thing they want to do is complain or certainly publicly complain.
Yeah, well, I think if you are that successful as an artist, you probably have a gallerist who tells you maybe not to talk about that
right.
sort of thing in interviews.
Yeah, exactly.
It's bad for business.
Totally. Okay. So what this is, again, Wasu's piece, That Feeling When, What Affect Theory Teaches About the New Age of Anxiety. He wrote, towards the end of the piece. No one wants to be a bad or compromised kind of force in the world, but the latter is just inevitable, Berlant once wrote in a short essay on her personal credos. The question is how to develop ways to accentuate those contradictions, to interrupt their banality and to move them somewhere. And then he writes, we can build worlds out of these small ambitions. We continue to write, even if it occasionally feels as though we were spinning our wheels, and we continue to live, even if it means giving up the certainty that our story is going to end the way we want it to. And he finishes, writing on her blog a few years ago, Berlant issued what she described as her collective secret motto, we refuse to be worn out, which I guess is him picking up on some kind of that maybe the Sisyphean quality, you know, which he uses that word a little bit earlier. Maybe it's something about persistence.
I think so. And I think ultimately, I mean, one of the things I really like about Berlant's analysis of cruel optimism is, again, she's not interested in just making a kind of critique of what in an older generation of theorists might have called like false consciousness. She's actually saying that this is something that allows us to survive and cope, and particularly it's something that allows us to survive and cope and participate in society in communities. So, you know, cruelly optimistic communities are, you know, that's how a cruel optimism kind of sustains itself. The kind of myths that allow us to continue to participate are reproduced in amongst various people. So, you know, you might have an MFA graduating class, for instance, that is sort of cruelly optimistic that if they all work hard and play by the rules and really throw their whole heart and soul into their work, that they're, you know, they're going to get recognized. Or, you know, you have all sorts of different communities who essentially continue to participate in the system because the people around them are validating the sense that there is a chance that this will pay off in the end.
Right.
For me, in my work, I've really wanted to tie, I mean, Berlant ties this to neoliberalism and the idea of a society where increasingly we're all structured as individuals and where forms of collective care through the nation state, like healthcare, education, or old age security have been cut back. And so everyone has to rely on themselves. In my analysis, I certainly agree, but I also think that we need to account for this thing I've called financialization, where each of us is sort of transformed into an investor of the self. And it can't be denied that in the actual financial sector and in all sorts of financialized spheres of the economy, including the art world, hype, self-belief, confidence go a long way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have people whose entire careers are basically highly calibrated bluster, including the president of the world's largest and most powerful country. So, you know, there is something about cruel optimism that's structural and systemic and is connected to political economy in a really deep and profound way.
Right. Yeah, you know, you just reminded me of the term fake it till you make it. And I was particularly thinking about I haven't seen this movie in a long time, but you may be familiar with it. It's called Exit Through the Gift Shop. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, by Banksy.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, it featured Banksy, but also a lot of other quote-unquote street artists. And one of them, I think it was like Brain or something like that. There was one
Mr.
of them.
Brainwash.
Yeah, maybe it was Brainwash. If not Brainwash, another figure profiled in that documentary was completely it was the epitome of fake it till you make it, essentially. That was one of the things that I remember from that film. And indeed, you know, beyond, you know, the world of street art / graffiti / you know, juxtapose art, there's certainly cases in the quote unquote the high art world that are examples as well, which
certainly don't get
maybe written about. I don't know. Can you think back on academic writing? You know, because you talked about academic writing about Kuhn's, not that I'm citing him as an example, but you mentioned how it's been at least a decade since anybody in academia has written anything positive about him. Do you recall academic work about an artist that was described that way as a fake it till you make it artist?
Oh my goodness, not off the top of my head.
I know,
although
I'm putting you on the spot.
Always that concern. I mean, maybe the place to think about it is in the discourse that I think emerged. I'm trying to remember the exact dates. Sometime in the last 5 years around zombie formalism.
Right, that was actually around 2011, 2012, I think, that sort of...
Yeah, yeah, I mean, this really described a set of very young artists who were doing a kind of formalist abstract work that became extremely popular because of the kind of overheated contemporary art market.
Yeah.
And the kind of criticism that came from art critics was that essentially this work was essentially meaningless on some deep level, and that it certainly didn't deserve the accolades that it was receiving and the prices that it was achieving at the market, and that this was essentially the kind of triumph of hype over any sort of criterion of artistic excellence, and in particular that there was a kind of the work appreciated in value and prestige and notoriety simply because it was already appreciating in value and notoriety and prestige and, commentary. So there's a sense that there is this criticism. And, I mean, it's, you know, if you go into the back rooms of art parties, people talk about this all the time,
mm-hmm.
that lots and lots of artists who, you know, become quite popular are more hype than substance.
Right.
But, I mean, I think that in some ways is the norm within our economy right now. Like, you know, I was just looking at the Uber IPO, which is just an ongoing debacle that's happening right now. I mean, Uber is a company that most economists speculate could not feasibly actually turn a profit for the next 5 to 10 years unless they radically transform their business model. And yet, it appeared until it went public a couple of days ago that, you know, this firm was going to be valued at billions and billions and billions of dollars. So essentially what the business plan of Uber had been was to create so much hype that the share value, once the firm went public, would be so high that it would give the firm this massive influx of money to allow it to continue to survive. That seems to be falling apart. But I think it goes to show how deeply important hype is and how important optimism is as a kind of structure of feeling to the kind of financialized capitalism we're living in now.
Right. Yeah, you can fake a lot of things, but I don't know, is the jury still out on whether one can fake confidence?
I would frame it the other way, which is I think confidence is always just a kind of faking it or a kind of performance.
Wow.
In a funny way.
Well, thinking back, you were just involved in a conference that you co-ran. What was the title of it? Remind me.
Digital Debt Empire.
Digital Debt Empire. Thank you. So I would imagine that you encountered a number of individuals, you know, of your colleagues and of that community. And I would imagine that some of them came across as particularly confident, right? So if you can think of one or a couple, you know, that come to mind without obviously mentioning them, their names, do you think that they were faking it, or how much acting do you think they were doing? Let's put it that way.
I guess I'm of a school of sociological thinkers who feel that all public life is ultimately acting.
Right.
We are all playing multiple roles. We're all improvising all the time.
Yeah.
And as one makes one's way through life, one has that performance of self either accepted and validated by others or rejected and disbelieved by others in various ways. That doesn't mean that that's all there is to social life and everything's a sham. I mean, obviously we have authentic feelings and authentic relationships, but I think to a large extent, confidence is always a product of a kind of social system that one finds oneself in. And the performance of confidence is sometimes tactical in certain circumstances and not tactical in other circumstances.
Okay, so the next section to continue finally, and event we're finally going to get into another artwork here, is called Tactical Parasitics, and you actually were using the word tactical a few minutes back. And for whatever that's worth. I do want to ask you about your description of socially engaged art, essentially the participatory art, what have you, versus maybe the other kind, because I it gets a little counterintuitive towards the end. So let me just sort of read some excerpts from this. This is page 134 and 36 in the book. Page 136 in the book. You write, "Art and culture more broadly is now conceived largely as a means to other ends, which in part also helps explain the popularity of participatory art in this neoliberal moment. Within the neoliberal financialized framework, art that cannot justify itself through recourse to some social or economic outcome, some value-added experience, is merely parasitical. If, as we have been told, we are at the, quote, end of history, unquote, and no further social evolution is necessary or possible, or what Mark Fisher has called capitalist realism, art's critical role of alerting us to dangerous or hidden social trends or dynamics is largely pointless. This is the best of all possible worlds, or at least the inevitable one. Critical art appears increasingly as a weird and pretentious hobby funded either by the idiosyncratic largesse of private high net worth individual donors or some residual leaky capillary of the Keynesian state not yet cauterized by austerity." And we don't have to get too much into the weeds of that latter, the latter part of that sentence, but the reason that I was a little, that I'm a little, I need a little clarification here is because you talk about how, you talk about the parasitical nature of art that is sort of not, this is the way I'm interpreting it, that is not offering this value-added experience, some recourse to some social or economic outcome. And so I think you're kind of talking about sort of object, you know, market-based work, but then where I get confused is then you say critical art appears increasingly as a weird and pretentious hobby. So you went from implying to me, you know, of a more sort of formal or object-based art, and then you talk about critical art. So what do you mean, I guess, to start off, what do you mean by critical art?
Well, let me try and put this in a kind of genealogy. So I think if we go back to the work of the critics of the Frankfurt School, like Theodor Adorno or Herbert Marcuse, there was a concern already in the middle of the 20th century that art, which should be a sort of realm for experimentation and play, and a sort of, to go back to the Kantian tradition, this kind of purposeless activity that is just sort of the expression of the human imagination. Already in the middle of the 20th century, there's this concern that it's being instrumentalized, that it's being transformed into a means towards an end rather than an end in and of itself. And, you know, in earlier moments, we can certainly see this in the way that art gets instrumentalized in terms of becoming a commodity that rich people can buy. Mm-hmm. We can see it in terms of the way that art gets instrumentalized, for instance, today in many school classrooms. And I should say sort of upper-class school classrooms, because art has just been cut from working-class people's schools almost completely. But, you know, the idea is we're not teaching children to make art because it's inherently good for them and it's a part of the human experience. We're teaching them art because, lo and behold, someone has developed a statistical metric that shows that it helps them with math skills, or that it helps develop a kind of marketizable creativity or imagination that can, you know, in the future will pay off. Or, you know, it will give them some hobby that will allow them to be more successful later in life or something like this. There's a kind of sense that the art that we're training children to do is not just about their joy and thriving the human spirit, but towards these other instrumental ends. So throughout society, there's been this kind of instrumentalization of art. But what I'm and then there's also the instrumentalization of art that people like Adorno and Marcuse condemned, even by activists. You know, Adorno and Marcuse were both quite skeptical towards activist art, believing that art had to serve a function of holding open a space for something that escaped the reality principle of society, that showed that there was another world beyond this one. It shouldn't be committed to the kind of explicit political goals. Marcuse sort of backed off from that position near the end of his life, but it's also for them this other form of instrumentalization. Okay, what I'm sort of suggesting in this chapter is that that instrumentalization has in fact accelerated and increased in our neoliberal moment, and it's accelerated and increased precisely because so much funding has been cut to all sorts of other things. So, you know, it might have been the case that at one point in time, you had sort of pretty robust programming to take care of children at risk, you know, children in poor communities who are at risk of falling prey to criminal behavior as it's conceived of by the state and other hazards. And, you know, you might have addressed this by, for instance, making sure that all the children get a breakfast and a lunch because they might not be getting it home. Or you might address it by, you know, a robust set of social programs. Well, in the neoliberal financialized period, governments are starved of revenue and cut these programs back. And what begins to emerge is that art galleries, art institutions, and artists themselves end up becoming these kind of strange proxy social workers. Huge number of artists I've met have sort of worked in these fields where ultimately the artist becomes a kind of caregiver for society. And I don't think in and of itself that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I would certainly prefer that poor kids have art programming than not have it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I'm suggesting, and also other art sort of critics and political economists of art have suggested, is that there's something very strange going on where we imagine that art can solve social problems that maybe it's not actually art's place to try and solve. Another way of thinking about this is as what the critic Jorge Yudasis calls the expediency of culture. That today, weirdly enough, culture, and we could narrow that down to art, gets sort of called upon to do all sorts of strange things. And I'll just give you a final example, which is the incredible popularity over the past 15 or 20 years of the notion of the sort of creative city. That if you can build a city in which artists want to live and other creative people, it will attract economic development and all sorts of good things. And there's a strange way that here art, just let's speak narrowly of that, gets sort of marshaled into urban planning, economic development, in a very, very strange way that, you know, 100 years ago even would have been completely foreign to the ears of most people. And there's some things to be gained in that circumstance, but a lot gets lost as well. What I'm trying to suggest in these passages is that even critical art, art that is making critique of society, it gets conscripted often into this instrumentalization of art. And I'm not necessarily suggesting that's all bad. I just think that artists and those involved in the arts need to be more aware and more savvy that that's happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do specifically connect critical art in this particular sentence to being collected by high net individuals, or, you know, or if not collected, funded by, you know, what maybe, and I know you don't like to single things out maybe in these kinds of contexts, but is there an example or two maybe that you wouldn't mind throwing into this sentence?
I was just a few weeks ago reading a manuscript by a colleague, Yoon Song Kim at Northeastern University, who's done a very, very good analysis of how the market was created for the works of Santiago Sierra, who is a self-confessed anarchist from sort of the Spanish anarchist tradition, and makes very critical, very provocative work, you know, very famous for tattooing lines across the backs of migrant workers and using sort of minimal amounts of money to buy the services of extremely precarious, usually racialized human beings to make them do things that are sort of humiliating. And I think that she points out that the way that the market for Sierra's work has been constructed, and here she's thinking not only about the private market for the images that are produced of his sort of interventions, but also the international market that is presented by major arts institutions and museums, often public museums and institutions that fund and commission his work. is really dependent on him and others around him and critics around him generating a critical discourse about his work to suggest that this isn't just some scumbag paying a bunch of people to be exploited and humiliating them, that in fact this work has some sort of critical reflexive quality that therefore justifies or explains or legitimizes the horrible things that he's doing to human beings.
Mm.
So I think that's a fine example that she provides of a place where critical art is also part of the same circuits that it often is allegedly criticizing.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that Kim, I think, rightly puts is, who ends up paying? Not just who pays the money, but who ends up paying? Who ends up paying for this art in terms of
right.
their body, their time, their dignity?
And this is it Sierra, this guy's name?
Yeah, Santiago Sierra.
To what extent, to your knowledge, does he have a reasonable market, you know, for these projects or for his work in general?
There was a very interesting article about 10 or 15 years ago by Malcolm Bull, I believe. I'd have to double check that. But he encouraged us to think about the market as an art market as occurring on two poles. There's some artists who do extremely well on auction markets, but
sure.
are almost never exhibited in major international museums that have legitimacy. And then there are some artists who do extremely well in international museums and galleries and, you know, have big sold-out blockbuster shows with their name on posters all over the city, but whose work doesn't necessarily sell extremely well on markets. And I think that Sierra is one of the latter.
Yeah.
But as we've talked about, I think, in a previous episode of our conversation, the two can never be separated from one another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a major commercial gallery may have a number of poorly selling performance artists or artists working in kind of marginal media, someone like Santiago Sierra. I don't know who represents him as a commercial gallery.
Right.
But those artists essentially exist in order to create the atmosphere of contemporaneity and criticality
sure.
that then ultimately buoys up the sales of those people who are actually willing to put a 4x4 foot canvas on the wall of someone's yacht.
Right.
So Sierra himself might not actually be making a ton of money
right.
By selling images of his work, although Kim's analysis seems to indicate that there is a fairly swift trade in photographs of it. But he still plays a role, and I don't think he would, in fact, even disagree with that if we were to sit down and talk
right.
to him, although he's notoriously slippery in interviews.
Yeah, I will definitely look up his representation, but that's definitely a point well taken. And I have asked gallerists in the past, and I got, speaking of slippery, I got a slippery answer, but I asked, so you basically have... you know, a couple or a few artists who are consistently high selling, you know, a great percentage, if not all of their work sell in their shows. And that allows you to have more experimental artists, you know, be part of the program. And, you know, of course I got that slippery sort of answer. Well, we think of all of our artists, you know, dot, dot, dot. So anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for your patience, Max, and listeners. We have finally reached the moment. Well, actually, we still have another preface to this artist, but I'm going to at least mention his name. It's Paolo Sirio, the Italian artist. And before I get into the description that you write about this piece, which is just to me the peak of fascination, I do want to put it in the context of the shell game of, you know, financialization and offshore banks and so on. And that can come courtesy of this book that you and I both separately read called Capital Without Borders, Wealth Managers and the 1% by Brooke Harrington, who herself, through the process of writing the book, got her feet quite wet in being a wealth manager to whatever extent she was able to. So she got to some extent be on the front lines. And before I let you share whatever maybe takeaway you have, I think a really concise takeaway for me of that book that will lend to this particular artwork that we're about to talk about is that the system is rigged and the wealthy, particularly generations of wealthy, are able to hold on and grow in, you know, in most cases, their inheritances or you know, their net worths through the sketchy, crooked maneuverings of wealth managers who, you know, keep the taxes to an absurdly low amount. That's basically my takeaway.
Yep, that's that about covers it. I mean, I think that I guess I would say just two quick things about it. I mean, I'm very encouraged that in the last few years, tax havens have received so much attention because it really is the means by which the world's, the proverbial and literal 1%, or really even the 0.1%, are able to sneak their kind of ill-gotten gains out of the countries where they live and therefore avoid sharing it with the people that they've exploited to make all that money. So, you know, usually states have some degree of taxation to try and redistribute wealth in some way, although less and less these days. But these individuals and firms have basically avoided that completely. So it ends up draining society of its wealth and contributing to what has amounted to a system of, like, vast and growing inequalities, inequalities that rival the most heinous empires of the past,
right,
with a tiny, tiny, tiny fragment of humanity controlling absurd amounts of wealth. The second thing I would say, though, is that I am, as much as I am sympathetic to efforts to try and repatriate those funds, and again use them to tax them appropriately so that the money can be returned to the society from which it emerged, I also just don't believe that we should have billionaires. And I think that we need to kind of eliminate the possibility in a society where anyone can accumulate that much money, regardless of if it gets taxed to some rate or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think more generally, there's a bit of there's some double standards at work when so-called first world countries or countries in the global north that are quite wealthy cry foul about all of this wealth being sucked from their coffers and from their populations, when in fact most of those countries are wealthy precisely because they did the same thing on a systemic level through colonization to countries in the global south for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're going to demand that England, for instance, get all of the billions back that have been put into offshore tax havens, then India definitely has a claim that the billions and billions and billions, perhaps trillions of dollars by today's standards, that were extracted from India over the course of the tenure of the East India Company and later the British Raj, should be repatriated as well. And likewise, in the United States, reparations for slavery, or in my country of Canada, reparations and restoration of indigenous lands. So I am definitely up for opening that Pandora's box, but I think it's less clearly cut than it's often presented.
I'm with you on the capping it somewhere before a billion. And I don't know if that's, I don't know if that's a radical, perspective, belief or not. I'd be curious to know what listeners, how listeners weigh in on, you know, how much is enough and what is a limit in terms of how rich people can be in this country, for one. So maybe this will be provocative enough for people to weigh in, maybe not. But getting back to the piece, I think it's important to mention that book and those sentiments as we finally get to Loophole for All, which is the name of the piece. This is page 137. And this is connected with all of the things that you have been talking about, we have been talking about tactical parasitics, because that is the section that it comes in. You write, a fine example of parasite-oriented participatory artwork is Paolo Cirio's 2014 work, Loophole for All. The artist whose work has targeted the shadow worlds of data and money hacked the website of the Cayman Islands General Registry of Companies, the vehicle through which some of the world's richest people and corporations set up shell companies in their notorious tax haven in order to avoid paying taxes in their home countries. This allowed Serio to collect and publish the hitherto unknown names of over 200,000 firms, many of which were simply numbered corporations or ambiguously titled companies, and develop a website where, for prices starting as low as 99 cents, anyone could purchase a forged certificate of ownership of that company. Presumably, one could then operate financially as a parasite on that company's identity, issuing invoices and receiving payments in their name, but redirecting the funds to oneself. Depending of jurisdiction, one could declare one's business in the Cayman Islands, yet hold the bank account in one's actual zone of operations, as is the norm for wealthy people and corporations who abuse tax havens. While ultimately this might be considered a form of fraud, the reality is that the Cayman Islands and other tax havens are so secretive and generally lawless, and the global financial architecture is so complex and mediated by subsidiary law firms and subsidiaries that proving that the original corporate or billionaire who purchased the company is its, quote, rightful owner may be challenging. In any case, the Registry of Stocks of the Cayman Islands acted swiftly, both issuing press releases announcing Serio's work as a hoax and complaining to the online payments platform, PayPal, who promptly suspended Serio's account, putting an end to the sale of certificates and freezing the roughly $700 he had so far earned from the project. This is all especially ironic given the role that art plays in the offshore machinations of the super elite. Ultimately, the would-be participant, the figure we might once have called the audience, is hailed into a kind of sly solidarity with the artist. Serio's loophole for all is not primarily intended to redirect global resources. It is a deeply cunning intervention at the intersection of multiple overlapping parasitic economies. First, of course, the parasitic economy of the world of tax havens. Second, the parasitic online attention economy that will allow his intervention to travel. Third, the art economy itself, because, like Well and Orta, an artist that you mentioned earlier on in the book, Serio here is an activist mobilizing art as an alibi for undertaking paralegal acts, or perhaps an artist using activist tactics to create aesthetic and critical impacts in a deeply changed parasitic economic and political ecology that we are only now beginning to understand. Ultimately, Serio's intervention aimed to prove that the seemingly invincible, untouchable, transnational financialized elite are in some sense vulnerable. In this sense, the work might appear more spectacular than participatory, more in line with the strategies of tactical media and the prankish interventions of ensembles like RTM Mark, the Electronic Disturbance Theater, or the Yes Men, who I believe you mentioned in our last conversation. So maybe before we jump in, or you dive in, I should say, I recall that there is an image that goes along with this, but correct me if I'm wrong, but this is maybe the epitome of an artwork that is much more interesting to sort of hear about anecdotally than to actually consume visually as a piece.
Yeah, but I think intentionally so. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what is... what Serio is so good at is recognizing the whole ecosystem in which he works. So he's very savvy to recognize that the piece needs to work as something you can kind of tell someone about at a party and they get kind of enough of an impression about it.
Right.
So the piece is intended to work more discursively than it is to work visually.
Right.
Although the visual itself, you know, in the gallery exhibitions is quite charismatic in its own way.
Mm-hmm. So I guess my first question is, maybe we should focus on this piece. I was going to ask you about Serio's other projects. You know, there's clearly a direct impact from a piece like this. You know, he directly affected the Registry of Stocks of the Cayman Islands. How do you feel something like this reverberates, though, into the future? I mean, this is now already 5 years old. So, you know, is this maybe an example of kind of chipping away at the powers that be? Is that maybe the best lens to see it through? Or is it maybe more impactful even than that in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately it, as I kind of say in the passage you read, I think what it does is it hails, to use a kind of a theoretical language, it calls out to the person that we might have once called the audience, and let's call them the audience for now, in any case, the person who hears about his work, us, the two of us, and all the people that you're listening to your podcast, because it has that kind of viral quality to it. It calls out to all of us to realize both the situation that's going on and where we stand in that situation in a very interesting way. So, I mean, many of us have heard about tax havens before from Brooke Harrington's book or from, you know, the news, from the Panama Papers and other revelations such as those. But there's a kind of it all seems very distant and also very complex. And like it's something that us mere mortals could never really understand, let alone intervene in. And I think what Sirio's intervention does is like when people hear about it, they're like, you can do that? You know, that is something that you can actually do. You can sort of in a Promethean way steal fire from these financial gods who seem untouchable.
Right.
You can actually do something to hurt them. I think that's what the efficacy of the work is. I don't know if the loophole that he found has been closed now, but I think whether it's been closed or not, and the system has, of course, adapted and changed, and these things change quite rapidly, there's still a sense that the piece gives us a kind of moment of common courage where we're like, oh, actually, if we look closely enough, we can see the sort of soft spot in the otherwise hard armor of this system.
Right. And are you aware of any work that he's made since this piece, by any chance?
Just give me a second. He has been making very interesting work recently. I'm just trying to remember some of the... he's been doing a lot of work. I mean, he's curated a very interesting show called Evidentiary Realism, which looks at a number of artists like him who do this kind of deep and intensive... research into systems of injustice and then use art as a mechanism to reveal them. He's also been doing he did another quite well-known piece called The Daily Paywall, where what he did is he bought subscriptions to all of these periodicals and newspapers that usually have a paywall when you go on their website, and he basically collated all of these into a single website where you could read all of them and sort of get behind the paywall that way. And in the same case as Loophole for All, it got shut down quite quickly.
Right.
He did another intervention around there was a particular way that in the United States, these companies would trawl around the internet looking for mugshots of people who had been arrested that are sometimes in the public domain or sometimes simply poorly protected by whoever owns those mugshots, and then posts them online and then, you know, basically makes you pay if you want them to be removed. Otherwise, people can search a database and, you know, when they search your name, they find a mugshot of when you were arrested for, whatever you were arrested for. Of course, in the United States, many people get arrested and, in fact, convicted for things they should never be arrested or convicted for. But that can have terrible consequences on your ability to rent an apartment or get a mortgage or get a job or work in a school or with others, you know, so-called vulnerable populations.
Right.
So his intervention in that was to create a kind of rival database, I think, where I think, if I remember the project correctly, faces and names were scrambled. So it kind of added noise to the way in which that sort of form of synoptic surveillance was operating. So I think in all of these cases, I won't say that word. You hate that word.
His work.
His artwork.
Yeah. Thank you.
And his work, let's just say,
yeah.
Is about doing this kind of intensive research into systems as they exist and then finding a small way to sort of strike back at them, which is also, I think, the tactic of a number of artists covered in this book that we might talk about. Notably also Cassie Thornton and others.
Yeah. You know, as you're talking about his other work, I was thinking back particularly to this piece that we just talked about and wondering if First of all, I was thinking that it loophole for all. I was thinking that this is a perfect hybrid of art and activism on one hand. But then, as I was meditating on that just for a moment longer, I thought, what is the importance of this being called an art piece? I mean, certainly as we mentioned very briefly, you know, there was a visual element to this as it was exhibited. But as you to go back to your example, talking about describing this piece at a party, Paolo could just as easily have said, I did this activist thing or intervention, or I'm an activist, and I did one of my activist projects was hacking into the Cayman Islands General Registry, you know, and this is what happened. You know what I mean? So all that said, without maybe laboring it too much, if possible, why, for this particular piece, is it relevant or important that it is an art piece?
Well, I think as a form of activism, it's not particularly effective because ultimately it. While I could go on and buy the right to call myself Apple Computer and then, you know, use that in various ways, it's pretty unlikely that most people who go on and buy a certificate as he had it would actually use it for the actually illegal purposes that, you know, are suggested. So in a way, it's not really a form of activism in the sense that it allows people to do something. I mean, it does, but it's unlikely that they would do it. It's more a form of activism in the sense that it works on the level of discourse and symbolism and networks. And I think on one level, we should call it art because ultimately it is operating on in many of the same registers that political art generally operates in, which is making us think again about the way that the world is organized, challenging our imagination, communicating something outside the realm of the normal. But second of all, I think, and maybe this is more important, by labeling it art, then Sirio allows the work to enter into different sorts of networks of publicity. You know, if he basically was like, if he wasn't an artist, if he was just an activist, and this happened, there would be no news story about it. It's the, you know, no journalist, you know, is like prankster steals a bunch of names of companies and sells them on the internet. It's not a story. Artist does that, and now you have a story. And so I think he's occupying the realm of art because of the residual prestige that our society still associates with art, that somehow we should pay attention to it. But also because, as Warhol put it in very distant circumstances, I mean, art is what you can get away with, and you can get away with a lot by calling things art.
That's a really important sentiment, and it kind of goes back to one of the questions we've talked about maybe in the first conversation. But even the thesis, one of the theses of your book, you know, which is using art to execute interventions or challenges to or questioning of financialization, is a license that you don't get. And when you made that comparison of if it was just some prankster doing this, you know, it would just kind of so it made me think, well, so activists in this equation are just kind of like the sad blue collar, you know, working class, you know, go to work, clock in, come home kind of situation, whereas the artist, you know, gets to be all, you know, fantastical and, you know, and celebrated and what have you, and by comparison.
Yeah, I think so. But also, by the same token, gets to reach a much wider spectrum of people.
Which is pretty ironic,
and I think
actually,
that the artists that I'm most interested in the book are ones who are really, and I think Sirio is a kind of a master of this, of really thinking through his strategic location as an artist with certain skills, with certain interests, and seeing how far he can sort of leverage that to get away with these political interventions.
Do you not think, though, meanwhile, I mean, just to take, because I would imagine you have a fair amount of knowledge of maybe the activist culture, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but do not, you know, professional, or maybe that's the wrong adjective to use, but experienced activists, do they not themselves carefully strategize and think through the projects that they're going to execute in a similar way? And so the only in that example, the only thing that they're lacking is the opportunity for greater reach and press?
I suppose so. But like if we take the the example of tax havens again and sort of the Cayman Islands, if we were a group of activists and thinking through how we wanted to make an intervention into that space or draw attention to that space, we would probably design a very different campaign with a very different language and a very different discourse than Serio did.
Right.
Because essentially you want to push on the levers of power in a much different way.
Yeah.
So, you know, I definitely think that activist groups should use more techniques cultivated from the arts. And in fact, it's one of the reasons why I wrote this book with activists in mind, is I actually think that these sorts of techniques could be very useful to the kinds of mobilizations we need to challenge the powers that be. But I think the habit in activism is to use a very different sort of approach, a much more conservative, I mean, small-c conservative approach to raising awareness about issues and lobbying and putting mm-hmm. pressure and sort of mobilizing people.
So one of your maybe core readers or your target reader would be an activist who would get more bang for his or her buck by hybridizing it into art.
Yeah. I think
yeah.
so, or yeah. at least recognizing what art and artists might be able to offer to struggles. And I should say that many, I would say perhaps even most of the artists that are profiled in the book are also activists,
mm-hmm.
And in their other walks of life are participants in social movements or work in alignment with social movements. I know, you know, Serio talks quite openly about his affinities to sort of radical politics, but I've heard him speak about this, and really thinking through a kind of division of labor that, you know, there's things that art is never going to be able to achieve. And, you know, it's a cruel optimism to imagine that art is going to be able to totally radically transform society. That's just not how societies change.
Mm.
But art can help us think about how to change society if it can't change society itself.
Mm-hmm.
It can help us think about how things are connected that we didn't see before. It can help us think about how power works and how resistance might work. And I think that's important as long as we don't sort of hyperbolize what art can or should do.
Right. Okay. Well, in the interest of time, let's move on to Market for Material Value. This is on page 143, and we'll obviously do a very abbreviated version of the text from this because I really went two or three page crazy with this one. But so Valentina Karga and Peter Jan Grandry are the pair, the collaborators in this Market for Material Value, most notably in terms of our interest in what you wrote about, this piece they made called Valentina and Peter Invest in Themselves. So Valentina and Peter Invest in Themselves is a specially minted gold coin whose value is determined by equity sold to an expanding group of public investors who then collectively own the work. Envisaged as a kind of pension platform for the artists and their small-time investors, its central commodity is not subject to the speculative fluctuations of the art market, but steadily rising in value as new investors join. So I will say, and I'll try to remember to include this on the webpage for this episode, that I went and watched this like 5-minute YouTube video that's sort of a kind of a new agey PR piece for this PR video for this piece, and it's quite beautiful, actually. I thought it was incredibly well done and makes me really appreciate what, you know, their sensibility even more. But so people can watch that, but why don't you maybe, can you break down in vernacular so I don't read, you know, several paragraphs, what this piece's structure is like, because I have a little hard time kind of digesting the, you know, the way that the investors come on and how, you know, depending on how much they put in, I guess they get a certain share and how that plays out over time, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny project in a lot of ways. So, I mean, it takes the form of this gold coin and it goes and sort of travels around and gets put in group shows and various other artistic venues. And then Valentina and Peter Jan sort of show up and they'll host kind of meetings where they try and get people to invest in the coin. And the idea is that everyone's going to come and put their money on the table and you might invest, you know, €5 or you might invest €100. And the idea is that this is going to give you a share in the coin, and then when then all of those shareholders become voting interests ultimately in the future of that coin and what can be done with that coin, including the artists themselves. And then at the point when that those shareholders determine that they wish to sell the coin, it can be sold and everyone will get a cut of the proceeds.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a contract associated with it. But there's a few features of this that are kind of skewed or slant in intentional ways. One of them is that regardless of how much you invest in the coin, you still have the exact same voting rights. So if you invest 5 euros and I invest 5,000 euros, we each just get a vote. So it's unlike most stock, most corporate stocks in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, it's the only people who actually have the list of all of the investors and could feasibly call an investment meeting are the artists themselves, who are no longer collaborating on this piece together. So that hypothetical community around the artists of these investors is ultimately purely notional in, you know, there's never going to be a meeting of investors. And even if there was, what, like, I would fly from Canada, you would fly from the United States, somebody else would fly from Japan, it's unlikely that all the investors are going to get together and meet. So ultimately, there's a kind of parafictional quality to the way in which the coin itself and the coin as a representation of the value of the artist's labor is being presented. But in my reading of the piece, the flaw in the concept is intentional. The flaw in the, or at least if not intentional, then felicitous, because it reveals the flaws in the relationship between artists and the market more generally. First and foremost, the fact that the vast majority of artists never get rewarded adequately for their contributions to society. But second of all, even those, that sort of proverbial 1% of artists who do, whose work actually does enter into some sort of art market, also are usually the subject of extremely exploitative contracts where they're taken for a complete ride by their gallerists and by the collectors. And, you know, we need only look at the horrors of the secondary art market, where a painting that sold for $10,000 yesterday sells for $100,000 a month from now, and the artist gets none of the proceeds from that secondary sale, except in certain very specific contexts, I think like France. To see just how sort of terribly exploitative the markets for art are.
Right, right. I didn't realize, you know, for some reason I didn't catch that it was only this one gold. So it's only this one gold coin? They don't make multiple?
No, it's just one.
Right.
One coin. Yeah.
Wow. So as part of this fiction, is that what you called it? Parafiction?
A parafiction.
Parafiction, yeah. There is this notion or sentiment that they are putting forward that they are creating their own market. You know, they're not letting anybody else have any say or control over it. So they're presenting a sort of idealized imagination for how one's work will grow in value.
Yes, in a certain sense. They are fabricating a market where one didn't exist before, because neither of them are particularly well-known artists, so they're both working.
Yeah.
They do get commissions, you know. But they're not the sort of artists, and generally their work is not the sort of work that's going to be sold for big bucks at art fairs and, you know, Sotheby's or whatever.
Right.
So they are, in a sense, hallucinating a market for their work. But the market itself is really a kind of proxy for a community, because, you know, all of the people who buy shares are people who've come to the show, usually people that the artists know themselves. And in a weird way, I think that is actually, there's something very revealing about that in terms of how economies work. You know, our huge global financialized economy, of course, is extremely anonymous, but as anonymous as it is, and it's still really defined by human relationships. Whether that's, you know, the relationship between traders who can pick up the phone and make a deal, or between the CEOs of hedge funds who, you know, make a backroom agreement, or it's the relationships that form between clients and service providers. You know, as a number of economic sociologists have pointed out, relationships really do matter in the capitalist economy, and they certainly matter in an extreme way within the art economy, in the sense that, you know, what the gallerist's sort of most precious asset in some ways is their proverbial Rolodex. It's who you know, your ability to manipulate and cajole and convince and seduce collectors to buy this artist and not that artist, your ability to hassle museums to display this artist, your ability to get the pride of place in an art fair. I mean, there's so many ways in which the art market really relies, almost like no other sector of the capitalist economy, on this kind of infrastructure of relationality.
Mm-hmm.
So I see all of this in the sort of background to this piece.
Right. And meanwhile, the artists themselves, Valentina and Peter, are using the whatever art fairs or biennials, I should say, that they're participating in, perhaps as their own form of propping up or, you know, lending value to this particular piece, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, it's a portrait of the artist as hustler, and I think that is actually a very realistic portrait of the artist in
right,
this day and age.
Right,
unfortunately,
yeah. Did you buy a share yourself?
I didn't. No.
Okay. Yeah. I guess you probably would have felt like that might have been a conflict of interest or thing that you were writing about them. But do you know it?
Yeah. I tried to avoid buying into any of the artistic schemes around money.
Right.
With one huge notable exception, which maybe we'll get to later.
Yeah. You mean like in a second? But do you know as far as its current state by any chance? I mean, I didn't notice that I can recall. I just remember going to Valentina's website and seeing that it was among her projects, but I don't recall seeing any easy way to determine, you know, where this particular piece is at currently as far as its value or anything like that.
The last time I talked to Valentina, she said that these two artists weren't working together and collaborating any longer,
mm-hmm.
and that the piece, I don't think the piece had been exhibited in a while. But I gather that if the piece were exhibited again, it would, you know, once again be open for investment.
Yeah.
And I think this is also an interesting aspect of the piece, is it is a complete open-ended investment. There's no limit to the number of shares that they're going to sell. So, you know, if you and I and three other people bought shares at the beginning of the project, we would each have a sort of 1 in 7 voting right, but if they sold 5 million more shares, our initial investment may depreciate in value in terms of the power it holds over the. Yeah.
So moving on to page 150 now, we have this piece called "Give Me Cred," which I think bears some good introduction, which is what you wrote. Over the past decade in the U.S., FICO. Or FICO, F-I-C-O is the abbreviation, credit scores have become an essential financial technology with grave implications for daily life. It is not only the main criterion for approving individuals for access to debt, including credit cards, car loans, student loans, and mortgages, and determining the levels of interest they will pay. These days, credit reports are often demanded by prospective employers and landlords as a means to weed out allegedly untrustworthy clients. The generation of credit reports monopolized by three corporations is notoriously opaque and poorly regulated, and the generation of single FICO credit scores even more so. Yet their impacts are widely felt. Enter Cassie Thornton. Her work of creating alternative credit reports continued in the Bay Area in 2015 when she advertised on Craigslist to solicit volunteers, most of whom were struggling to find accommodation in San Francisco's rapidly gentrifying and highly financialized housing and rental markets. Thornton asked participants for their resumes and official credit reports before meeting them in cafes or at their homes for an interview, which clarified the way their personal biography and their economic conditions of debt and delinquency intersected. Then the artist drafted a short alternative credit report explaining the participant's circumstances and offering her opinion of the latter's trustworthiness in a holistic sense. Participants were invited to edit the reports before a final signed digital file on special letterhead was provided to them for their use while searching for accommodation or employment. Thornton reports that participants experience a surprisingly high level of success using the alternative credit reports, but she measures the effectiveness of the project in the way it helped challenge the frameworks of value and narratives of success and trustworthiness implicit in the official credit reporting industry and the wider debt-driven financialized economy of which it is a part. So to just briefly summarize, Cassie Thornton created these alternative credit reports with no backing or legitimization per se that these volunteers or, you know, participants found via Craigslist were able to use in many cases for procuring housing and employment, if I get that right?
Yep.
Which is an amazing accomplishment.
Yeah, it was quite remarkable. And, you know, since she did this project, I don't know if it's was directly inspired by it, but a number of non-governmental organizations and community groups have started to do a similar thing, where recognizing that people have a hard time getting a good credit reference, they've started to do a similar sort of process where they do a kind of narrative of the person's life, and it's put in a person's portfolio instead of what you would usually get from Equifax.
Right. Wow. So here's an example. I mean, to dial back to Sirio's piece and our exchange about the relative impact of it. You know, here's a piece that's, as a piece of art and activism, that's having some substantial impact, not necessarily in terms of numbers, but just in terms of effectiveness. And that, I don't know to what extent that was the objective, but that's a very noteworthy, to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is that's a hallmark of Thornton's work across many of her projects, which all, I mean, she often works under the banner of the Feminist Economics Department.
Right.
As a kind of nom de guerre.
Right.
And that's kind of thematic of a lot of her work, is that it needs to be directly effective in people's lives, and usually people's lives who'd never want to or have never set foot in an art gallery.
Right. And as we briefly mentioned before we sort of officially started our recording, she, on the bottom of her website, feministeconomicsdepartment.com, she has the line on the bottom right, "If you steal any of my work, please tell me how it goes." Which is one of the more hilarious, you know, sign-offs a website can have. Maybe this is a good time as any to mention, speaking back to your reference to your relative level of, you know, complicity or conflict of interest, the fact that Cassie Thornton is your partner. If you don't mind, you don't have to get into the courtship per se, but maybe you can talk about how her life has been impacted by your relationship. Because one of the things that I didn't realize until I was looking around somewhere, I think it wasn't on her site, but on an interview that she recently did for this upcoming show in the UK that she has, that she's now a teacher in your department.
No, she doesn't teach at Lakehead, but she does co-direct along with me the Reimagining Value Action Lab, which is a kind of it's a physical space in which I'm sitting right now in Thunder Bay.
Right.
But it's also a platform for us to organize all sorts of events and conferences and residencies and other things.
And it's an extension of the university.
Yeah, it's part of the university.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And so, is that, like, in other words, for her, an adjunct type position?
Yeah, precisely.
Got
precisely.
It. Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess the first question is, maybe I'll make it a little more specific, because when you mentioned this, you know, in one of our prior email exchanges, it certainly raised the question for me. I've been in the past, I've certainly toned it down recently because I think I recognize my own complicity at certain points. But I was kind of a big conflict of interest hound, if you will.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of my favorite examples is when a couple of years ago, a gallery in Los Angeles, co-run by a man and a woman, not partners, but the woman... Mm-hmm. The husband of the woman had a show at that gallery, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I ran that by somebody and an artist too. I was an artist slash gallerist who I was talking about conflict of interest with, and he was like, you know. And then there's another example where there's a guy artist who is a co-director slash owner of a gallery, and he is part of the stable of this gallery. And you know, on one hand, you know, if you're a conflict of interest hound, you kind of think to yourself, you know, is that okay? But then as an artist or just anybody sort of struggling in the art world slash economy, you kind of want to say on the flip side, you know, anyway, you got to do it, you know? So mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I guess I'm of two minds, you know, it's a kind of a case by case basis.
Yeah. I mean, I have to freely admit the conflicts of interest, though. I'll tell you the story about how it came about in a moment. I guess, I mean, I think that what you're pointing towards is actually, if I'm blunt, I would suspect it's the norm rather than the exception.
Right.
I think the art world, there are forms of conflict of interest going on in the art market and the art world that would be not only unacceptable, but frankly illegal in almost any other sphere. But simply because it's the art market, it's fine. And, you know, people are connected to each other through a dense network of social relationships. You know, frankly, one of the major things that art collectors want from investing in the art market are the social opportunities.
Yeah.
And that means that people get together, people have relationships, whether they're romantic relationships or friendships or animosities or, you know, because the other side of it is, too, like lots of the things that go on, lots of the currents in the art market are, in fact, driven by the fact that certain people can't be in the same room with one another.
Because they can't
really,
stand each
I think,
other. Right?
We're what's that?
Because they can't stand each other's presence?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Because they, you know, they're divorced or because,
right.
You know, and interestingly, some of the best information we have about art collecting in the art markets come from divorce filings. Because, you know, people have to then have a kind of proceeding about how they're going to divvy up their, you know, their artwork
yeah.
or their interests in various things. So I digress, except to say that though, you know, obviously there's the conflict of interest here with me as a theorist and a critic and Cassie as an artist that I'm analyzing. I think that ultimately in the great hierarchy of sins associated with this part of the world, ours is fairly minor. And the one way that I would sort of justify it as well is to say that actually the inspiration for the whole book came from Cassie's work before we were in a relationship. In 2012, there was a show that was partly curated by a friend of mine, Leclaire LaBerge, who's a theorist at the CUNY system in New York, and a great curator named Laurel Patak in New York. The show was called To Have and To Owe. And Cassie was the sort of featured artist at that show. And at that time, I was doing work theorizing financialization, never had an interest in art. I had just got a job at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, so I was on the lookout for artwork that I could use to sort of explain to my students what financialization is, how money systems work, the things we've talked about in previous episodes. And I, you know, went to this show that my friend was curating, and there was Cassie and her work, and I thought it was just incredible. And in fact, it made me think, you know, oh my goodness, it's not just sort of us egg-headed theorists who are thinking about this thing called financialization. Artists are doing it, and they're making it accessible to wider publics. This kind of incredibly esoteric subject of debt and finance.
Mm-hmm.
And so, on some level, the book began at that moment and, you know, 5 or 6 years later manifested as a book. And in the intervening time, Cassie and I developed our relationship and now we're partners. So I felt, on the one hand, while I had some misgivings about including her work in the book, because, of course, the obvious conflict of interest, it would have felt dishonest in some way to not include it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And still to this day, I mean, she's both my favorite human being, but also my favorite artist. So
wow.
it all works out.
You can't
well.
Ask for more than that. does she now live in Thunder Bay, or do you guys go back and forth between California and Canada?
I would say back and forth. We're on the road a lot, both
wow.
for our respective
right.
our respective work.
So yeah. to trace the history of her piece, then, or her, getting into that show that you mentioned. Was it Give Me Cred that was in the show that you saw and that was curated by your friend? Or was it something else?
No, the piece that was in that show was a series of interventions she made. I believe the centerpiece of it was a huge paper mache boulder that had been created out of receipt slips from ATMs, which she'd collected from around New York.
Mm.
And that boulder became a kind of object of a series of kind of rituals of catharsis for indebted gallery goers who she organized them into a choir at one point, and they did a number of different activities with that boulder, which I think was eventually destroyed in a sort of spectacle at the end of the exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily recall at this moment whether the Give Me Cred project happened just after that.
Right.
That was the kind of next project she worked on. But before that, she'd worked on a project, and really the beginning of her work about debt was based on, during her MFA at the California College of the Arts, she started doing work to try and think through what it meant that art students were producing more debt than art.
Right, right.
And thinking about what else could sort of be done with the kind of psychic and social energies that were put into sort of worry and fear about debt, you know, if they could be redirected in some way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So was that piece with the boulder, if that was the one that was in that show, then discovered by one of the two curators from a show that was in the Bay Area, as far as you know?
Now, I don't know this story. I believe the curators discovered her work through the exhibition of her previous work on debt. Mm. And then they essentially commissioned her to do a piece at the gallery in New York, which I've been speaking about, the Tavern to Oman.
Right.
Cassie, or I guess I should now refer to her by her last name because we're speaking about her as an artistic entity. Thornton is rarely makes any piece that's not ephemeral.
Mm-hmm.
So almost all of her work exists only in the context of the exhibition.
Right.
Rather, she doesn't really produce objects.
Right, right. Got it. Well, I feel like I could ask more questions. Maybe they're best directed to her. I mean, one, just for starters, I would guess that she, at the California College of the Arts, that she was a bit of an outlier in terms of the type of artwork that she was making, if she was making, you know, anything along the lines of this debt work. But like I said, I could probably ask her about that, more directly.
It's interesting, yeah. And has a, mm-hmm. To answer briefly, and it has a slight bearing on a topic we mentioned before, which is that she was a graduate of the CCA's new social practice program, which was initiated by, among others, Ted Purvis, and very conscientiously, of all the people involved, was a kind of the establishment of that program at a large private institution like that, I think, was a kind of a significant moment in the institutionalization of the spheres of activity we now call social practice.
Well, see, that's I'm glad. I actually am really glad then that I asked that, because this takes me back to our first call, our first recording, and my sentiment about, well, you know, how do you make this kind of work? You know, it's not like, you know, you just, you know, you're making painting. And, well, I mean, of course, this, maybe with Lozano, this was an exception, but it's not like you're making painting or drawings or sculpture and then you go, oh, you know what, I want to challenge, you know, I want to talk about debt in my work, and I want to do it in a way that's direct. So then you mention this program, and I think, well, okay, well, that sounds like the type of incubation chamber that where these kinds of sensibilities and art-making habits, you know, can really be brought along, and to go back to earlier in this conversation, thinking about Paolo Sirio, you know, you mentioned that he's also an activist, but it's like, where does a mind like that come from? You know what I mean? To have that kind of gumption, that you know, that kind of chutzpah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in Thornton's case, it does have a genealogy. I think it's very much inspired by conceptual art, and the broader conceptual turn in cultural production in America since the 1960s. you know, that we can trace to Fluxus and the interventions like we talked about in our last conversation, for instance, Joseph Beuys, Hans Hacke, the Yippies and Abby Hoffman. So on the one hand, there's this kind of conceptual and activist turn that's now quite well established in art. And I think the second major influence there, part of that genealogy, would be feminist art as well, which, you know, had never really shied away from blurring the line between a kind of activist intervention and an artistic representation.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel, and then I think maybe a third tradition, which has a somewhat ambivalent relationship to participatory art and social practice as it's been configured today, is community art and community-based art,
right,
and public art.
Right.
And those traditions have a difficult relationship, I think, with the thing that's been branded as social practice or participatory art for a whole variety of reasons. But there is this kind of tradition, again, that we need to feel ambivalently about, because it is an instrumentalization of art, as the Frankfurt School theorists warned us about. But there is a sense that for the last 50 years, let's say, there has been a move towards conceptualizing art as a method of public intervention, political intervention, that's increasingly dovetailed with things like improvisational theater or, some of the more activist edges of poetry or filmmaking, too.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, whenever you say in public settings, I think of improv everywhere. I mean, you know, because mm-hmm. for to my mind, and maybe it's you've had a different experience, all of these types of performances that are related to the various categories that you talked about are all done in institutional settings, whether they're museum institutions or commercial gallery or alternative gallery institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Because anything that's then anything that's done in public per se, you know, I don't know. It has to be documented and then, you know, and then cataloged and written about in a book like yours, you know, for us to mm-hmm. find out about it. Essentially, it kind of goes back to that question I had about Lee Lozano, you know, doing these great this great piece around money and my thinking about the amazing shift from being a painter and doing this stuff and then wondering, here's what I was getting at. When I said, if somebody were to do that now, you know, in this landscape that we're in of social media and so on, you know, nobody would care. And you said, well, even at the time, maybe nobody cared. So, I mean, just to take that kind of, the nobody cares, aspect of art making, I guess maybe that's why people do these more performative intervention activist type events or doings in institutions so that they can be seen and documented, whereas if they do them out in the world, you know, they just get kind of swallowed up whole.
I think that's true. I think and in some ways, that's a good thing in the sense that it gives a kind of legitimacy and a longevity to the piece. And in many ways, that's a bad thing because mm-hmm. I've seen some incredibly brilliant works of art that are so brilliant and acute in their analysis and their intervention in society that will only ever be experienced or enjoyed, or if enjoyment is the right word, mm-hmm. by a tiny handful, select few of us.
Right, right.
And it's one of the things, again, you know, a conflict of interest, that it's one of the things that has always attracted me about Thornton's work is that mm-hmm. all of her work engages audiences that are typically not people who'd ever set foot in a gallery. And, you know, she's spoken on many occasions and in interviews about the kind of ethos of doing work that her mother, who's sort of a working class person in Indiana, could not necessarily, you know, be able to describe every aspect of it, but something that would be empowering and funny to her mother.
Right.
And that's a kind of litmus test for if the project is going to be worth doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, right. So I want to just ask you one more thing before we wrap up, and that is simply reflective of something that I was doing a little bit of between this conversation and our last one, which I was looking into I was looking into art and activism. What was the, all of a sudden blanking on the term. What is that hybrid term? Artivism.
Oh, artivism.
Yeah. So I was looking into artivism, and what would you recommend for people who are interested in finding out more about artivism in wherever they are?
There's a very good scholar who's written quite a bit about it and theorized it quite well named Stephen Duncombe,
okay.
D-U-N-C-O-M-B, who works at New York University. And he works very closely with, what's the guy's first name? His last name's Lambert.
Okay.
And Lambert is an artist. I mean, they work on artistic projects together, but they have a kind of whole institute for artistic activism or artivism. And I think that they're fairly, he's
plugged in.
Duncombe has, I think Duncombe's rating is quite good about it. I have my own, I think they have less time for more politically conceptual works that I have more time for.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, I think that they present a good kind of picture of how things are going. And I'll just mention one other, just to kind of get things out of the kind of Anglophone context, is I've been recently conversing with and writing some pieces about a Mexican artist named Minerva Cuevas, C-U-E-V-A-S.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she is really one of the savviest artistic activists working right
and
now.
And where is she based?
Very, very cunning. Based in Mexico City.
Okay. So I wonder if you interpreted my question as where people can learn about artivism, but I actually meant where can people get involved in artivism specifically.
Get involved?
Yeah.
You mean like, I mean, I think it's quite geographically specific because usually they're working on particular campaigns.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned this institute that Duncombe runs. Are they connected throughout the country, would you say, or not necessarily?
Yeah, I've seen that they go on tour and they do workshops. And similarly, the Yes Men have started something I think they call Yes Labs,
okay.
if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
And they sort of go and they work with groups to train people to do artivist interventions, sort of along the lines of their activities. There's also a group that someone that I mentioned last call when we were talking about art activism. John Jordan and Issa Fremo.
Yeah. I looked at their website actually, and in fact, this woman who through the Beautiful Trouble mentioned them. She said she had worked with them or something to that effect. So
Well, I think in Europe they're pretty active, and I know they travel around doing workshops, especially in the climate justice movement.
Right.
But there are others as well, and because I think all of the people I've mentioned to you are part of a kind of generation of artivistic interventions that, I mean, there are also lots of people who are doing artivistic things. Another person who's very interesting, but I don't know if she'd consider herself an artivist, but certainly uses a lot of the same techniques, is someone named Leslie Dreyer in the Bay Area.
Okay.
She works specifically on confronting the kind of destructive social impact of the tech sector on Francisco.
Right.
She's the one who organized these big protests against the Google buses and these kind of very raucous interventions.
Right. Okay, that's
great.
There's
the other people, and I think they're located in LA as well, who might be worth getting a hold of. Something called the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest. And they're very well connected to sort of art activist groups in LA. So those are some.
That's
some
great.
Link.
That's great. Thank you. Last question for you. Do you and or Cassie do any artivism or what have you on the side of the work that you do, would you say?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was just working here last month with a group of students from the community college who were doing a project about racist policing in our city. And so we were working with them to produce posters about it to put up around town. It was a pretty tame sort of intervention, but meaningful for those students.
Sure.
Cassie and I also work on a project called, it's maybe too much to get into, but it's called the University of the Phoenix, which is not to be mistaken for the University of Phoenix. And it's sort of a bit of a tongue-in-cheek sort of fictional institution of higher learning that teaches the living and the dead to rise up together against global capitalism. So we sort of do these performative seances. We do sort of walking tours and sort of performance lectures, and also kind of develop these sort of art activist repertoires for making certain kinds of interventions. So we do that together. And then, you know, Cassie's work in many ways often dovetails with a certain kind of artivist intervention as well.
Right, right, yeah. So it sounds like you're getting a little, getting to sort of take on the role of the artist to some extent.
Yeah, to some extent.
To some extent.
I try not to, cross the line too often.
Right, got it. You know. Well, I appreciate, as always, your wisdom, your knowledge, and your intelligence, Max, and your time. So thank you once again
so much.
So much.
It's always a pleasure.
Indeed. Thank you so much again to Max. I really, really enjoy talking to him and learning from him. And I hope you, some of you guys do as well. Do let us know what you think, will you? By going to theconversationpod.com or via social media when I post about it on Instagram, or, you know, just posting on Twitter yourself, or just, you know, private email is fine. Before we get to the Weiss Links old news for the week, four very tight ones, I want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. The tick up that started with the first conversation with Max has dropped off quite a bit, so with donations, I should say. So if you would like to support the show financially, it really does keep the show going. You can support the show a number of ways financially via theconversationpod.com/support. You can donate to the show via PayPal. You can do so via Venmo. You can do so via old-fashioned check. You could maybe donate an artwork. There are all sorts of possibilities. And we are now up to 8, actually soon to be 9, because there is a little bit of a segment. You may have noticed an abrupt transition around 20 minutes in or so, but Max talked about his upcoming book project on revenge, part of which involves extreme right men's groups. So we talked about that for a little bit, and pickup artists. We talked about that for a little bit in a bonus conversation, about 10 minutes, that I will be sending out to big donors of the show shortly, or a new donor of $20 or more. If you want to get all the bonus episodes, it's currently $35 or more to the show, one of those various ways. Thank you very much in advance. You can also support the show non-financially by leaving a nice review on whatever platform you listen on, spreading the word, sharing some nice thoughts, offering some questions for a future episode, plugging me or the show on social media, etc., etc. Thank you very much in any way that you care to contribute. Now let's get to the Weisslings, a.k.a. old news, or should I say old news, a.k.a. Weisslings. Number one of four. I hope my articles about the art world survive the mass extinction, a.k.a. Max. I'm not going to read from this one. I'm just going to let you know the title. Former guest, recent guest, Rainey Knutson, the soon-to-be outgoing publisher and editor of Glass Tire out of Texas, wrote a piece called Art is Not Entrepreneurship that Jeff Weiss featured in a recent Weiss Link. So if you want to check that out, hear what she has to say. Art is Not Entrepreneurship by Rainey Knutson on Glass Tire. Number three, Arts Entrepreneur is evicting longtime residents to create artist housing in San Francisco. When Carly Willmans bought David Ireland's former home in San Francisco's Mission District, there were laudatory articles saying that she had saved the legacy of the conceptual artist who died in 2009. Willmans, a board member of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art and the California College of the Arts, bought the house at 500 Cap Street in 2008 for $895,000 to preserve Ireland's work. She then formed the nonprofit 500 Cap Street Foundation and opened it to the public in 2016. When she bought it, Wilmans told the reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, "I knew if it went on the market, a developer would come and snap it up. I'm familiar with the gentrification process in the Mission." Now Wilmans seems to be on the other side of that gentrification process. She also owns a duplex adjacent to the David Ireland House and has started proceedings to evict the six tenants from the 20th Street residence, a woman in her 80s, her adult child, adult grandchildren, and some of their spouses. An email from Wilmans said she's away from her desk as of April 23 and has not yet responded. Her attorney, Scott Friedman, said through an assistant that he wouldn't be commenting on the situation. However, in April, Friedman told the San Francisco Examiner that Wilmans plans to, quote, donate the 20th Street building's use free of charge for temporary lodging by artists, curators, performers, unquote. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that 500 Cap Street Foundation is distancing itself from Wilmans' plans for artist housing. An email originating from the staff and board said, "The staff and the board were unaware of the details in regards to the legal proceeding. We have recently been briefed on the matter and have voiced our deep concerns." The letter adds, "The 500 Cap Street Foundation does not own or has ever owned the 20th Street residence." The tenant's attorney, Scott Collier, tells Hyperallergic that landlords can evict tenants under a California law, the Ellis Act, if they plan to go out of the rental business. But Collier isn't sure the law applies in this case, or if Wilmans' plan to donate the building to the 500 Cap Street Foundation would be violating the planning code by proposing a residence for institutional use. "It's not just the legality of the plan," Collier said. "It's the ethics as well." Quote, "The idea of evicting long-term low-income tenants so an institution can house visiting artists is not what we have housing for," Collier said. "I don't think a lot of artists would like to know they're being offered this housing off the backs of these low-income tenants," Hyperallergic. And finally, to go out on a lighter note, if you will, Mao Zedong drugs bust. Three Hong Kongers were arrested and more than Hong Kong $1 million worth of illegal drugs seized, including some hidden inside a bust of Mao Zedong, in two separate raids on Monday. Some 10 grams of suspected methamphetamine, also known as ice, was found in a sculpture of the late Chinese leader's head in a public flat at Hua Ming Estate in Fanling. Officers conducted the raid at 8 p.m. on Monday. And I think that's enough raids for this episode. Thank you guys very much for listening. Do let us know what you think. Please provide any questions that you may have for perhaps a final conversation with Max Haven coming up soon. I will talk to you in the near future. Thank you very much, and ciao for now.